Is this still season five? I don't know what season this is.
I think let's kick off a new season.
Oh, wow.
Season five was really long. I feel like we called it season five for over 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like...
And we haven't had a new episode in a while, so that's always a good reason
to flip the switch. Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block, season six of the two-time Telly Award-winning podcast, coming at you today like one Robert Craig Evil Knievel, better than P.T. Barnum and Colonel Parker put together, falling many times but never failing to get back up, making $60 million but trying like hell to spend 62. I am Rylan Grant, screenwriter, Ringo Award-winning creator of fine comics like Aberrant, Banjax, The Jump, and now, as I was sort of alluding to, the very first official Evil Knievel comic book series, which is on Kickstarter right now. Hit the pause button, go over there and pledge it. The other voice in the dark, the man in the box to the left, is...
David Avalone, writer, coffee achiever, Hollywood resident.
Love it. If you missed any of our previous conversations, episodes featuring comic luminaries like Patton Oswalt, David F. Walker, Matt Fraction, Stan Sakai, Kevin Eastman, and many, many more, our entire catalog can be celebrated via YouTube, iTunes, and other purveyors of worthwhile ear cracks. So double on back and check it all out. It has been a little while since we've done this. Avalone, how are you feeling?
I'm feeling okay. Yeah. We've both been ridiculously busy, which is good. And in these turbulent times, it's actually kind of rare to have enough work to keep you busy. But things have been clunking along. I had a book come out yesterday.
Oh, wow. What is it? Talk to me.
I got one of my short stories got selected for the best mystery stories of the year 2025. Selected by John Grisham, which is crazy to me.
I'm not familiar with his work, but
not familiar with his work. Obscure guy. I think he's mostly a lawyer.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
Primarily a lawyer, has done some writing. There's a movie where Tom Cruise runs a lot, and there's a piano on the score. I remember that. But
yeah,
it was very nice.
It's that movie where Tom Cruise runs a lot. That's the one,
right? Yes, that movie where Tom Cruise runs a lot. Yeah, okay. And there's a piano on the score. Yeah. It's my first mystery story, so I feel a little silly that they were nice enough to select it. And it actually started its life in an anthology called Friend of the Devil, which you should also pick up, which is a collection of short stories. I am the most unlikely candidate for this. A collection of short stories based on the works of the Grateful Dead.
Nice.
And I enjoy the Dead, but I am not what you would call a super fan. I am not following the Dead. I am not going to Dead concerts. I do not collect Dead bootlegs. But the editor, Josh Pachter, suggested the song The Golden Road to Ultimate Devotion, and it reminded me of a certain time and place in my life. And I took three anecdotal episodes, or I should say autobiographical episodes, and put them in a mystery story trench coat. And that was sufficient to convince people that it was a mystery story. It all jumps off from the fact that I had a relationship in the late 80s with a woman who had the most Ian Fleming name I have ever heard in my life. A real person. And we worked the night shift at a photomat factory. And I had that job from May to September every year. And this person who I was seeing at 6 a.m. from May to September every year, her real name was Dawn Summers.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Very nice. Yeah.
She was named after when we would see each other. So I appreciate that. Anyway, that's more than enough about that. But that book just dropped yesterday. You can get it at all fine bookstores, your library. There are two Telly Awards.
Yeah, we should say we got two of these too. I know I had one Telly of them Awards the last time but they look very handsome together. They're in love. Nice. This is the beginning of a long
fruitful relationship. But yeah, thanks to our listeners, our viewers who have made us a top 35 visual arts podcast on Apple Pods. Thanks for bringing us these, and we got a communicator award down there that's making sure my rug doesn't curl up.
That's what they're for.
Yeah, we've had a lot of fun with this. We got to talk to some wonderful people, and you know, it's all because you guys listen. So thank you for that. Definitely. But yeah, why don't we get to our esteemed guest?
Since our whole episode is going to be about what you've got going on right now, I think we can skip past that part and bring in Joe.
Yeah.
Hey, howdy! How's it going, guys?
Let's make it a threesome.
I guess we need a third telly. That's
right. That's what I'm talking about. These guys are in love.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So Joe, tell the kids at home a little bit about yourself.
Hey there, I'm Joe P from the Evel Knievel Museum. They call me Joe Friday. I have a thrill show podcast that's tracking the move that we're making from Kansas to Las Vegas.
Awesome.
And we should say that I am on the is it the current episode of the Thrill Show podcast or is it last week's episode?
You are. It's coming out monthly, so it would be this month. It coincided with the release of your Kickstarter campaign, Ryland.
Okay.
Yeah. So, nice. if you want more Evel Knievel talk, you can hop on over to the Thrill Show podcast and check us out. Joe and I had a nice conversation over there.
Let's dig into the origin of the Evel Knievel Museum and how did you get involved and what is it and where is it and where are you moving and all that.
So I was not a founder.
Oh, you dropped out.
When it came onto the horizon here, I have a steel manufacturing business and we specialize in stainless steel. And there was a local collector here. I also ride motorcycles. And the owner of the Harley shop, Mike, came over and wanted a bumper repaired. And I said, we don't do automotive. And he said, yeah, but this is Evel Knievel's and bumper that he got off this big red truck. And I said, well, does Evel Knievel have any money? not knowing anything about Evel Knievel, like he was already dead. But that started the relationship between me and Mike. And it ended up, I did repair that bumper. So the origin of the museum is Evel Knievel disappeared for a long time after 1977. Like he was on your radar, right, David? I don't know how old you are, but
I had the action figure, by the way.
Okay.
I had the action figure and the motorcycle when I was a kid. I can't remember what, if I had the set that had the ramp. I know I wanted the set that had the ramp, but I did have the action figure when I was a kid.
Yeah. Some, those are really cool.
Some Christmas, my parents got that for me, I'm quite sure.
Yeah, that outsold Barbie in 1974, Christmas of 1974. Yeah. So he was at the height of popularity and fame. He's in all the tabloids and on all the late night television shows. 1977, he falls out of favor with whoever's the fame gods are. And just drops out of our consciousness. So decades go by, and my friend Mike and Lathan, they open up an Evel Knievel Museum. It's got a dozen motorcycles and a half a dozen other vehicles, this big red circus wagon that if that thing rolls, it shows up in your town, you know something's going down. So that's how that started. I started volunteering there 8 years ago and worked there giving tours and listening to, you know, visitors' stories, which are much more interesting than mine.
People tell you stories about seeing him or about their personal relationship to Evel as a famous person or.
Right. Yeah. They all come in and they have this little winding action that looks like you might be a fishing buddy, but really it's them winding up their imaginary stunt cycle from 1975 or whenever it was.
They're evil Knievel toys. Yeah. Yeah. And so how we end up with Joe on the podcast is interesting because, you know, my company, the, you know, the production company behind this very podcast, Half Evil Comics, is producing the first official Evil Knievel comic book series, which of course is on Kickstarter right now. Again, maybe just pause the podcast and go over there and back it, get your copy, get your like cool evil swag, because there's plenty of it over there. But as you guys know, as I have covered sort of ad nauseum on this podcast, is I don't Google anything. That is a way to write vanilla ice cream, and I like Rocky Road. And so, whenever I dive into a new world, I need allies. I need people that will tell me, what I'm doing wrong and how things work and what the actual story was. The last thing I got paid to write in Hollywood was about Hell's Angels activity in the 1960s. And again, I didn't Google it. I went out and I had people introduce me to a bunch of outlaw bikers, and I hung out with them for about a year and got to know their stories and how they interact and what the code was and all of these things. And all of that ended up in the comic book. And so if you are going to write a comic book about Evel Knievel, and you want all the gear to look right, and you want all the stories to be dead on, then you surround yourself with people who know a lot about Evel Knievel. And so that started with Kelly Knievel, who is Evel Knievel's son and the brand owner. And you know, Kelly introduced me to Joe over at the Evel Knievel Museum, who has been very helpful and making sure that you know, we do things authentic and right. And getting the stories from them has been amazing. We debuted the comic book at San Diego Comic-Con. You can actually see the full video. I think it is up now. At the very least, the highlight reel is up, but the full panel will be up very soon in the next week or so on the Half Evil Comics YouTube channel. You can go and watch that. But we debuted the book at San Diego Comic-Con, a big Evel Knievel panel with Joe and with Kelly and with me and with Half Evil executive editor R. E. Nelson. So that's how we end up here.
Yeah, that panel was so interesting to me because when anybody comes to the Evel Knievel Museum, they're geared up, they're ready, they're having the best day of their life. It's a gift that wives would give to their husbands for their birthdays, bring them to Kansas for a tour of this museum. So what I'm saying is they had already bought in before they showed up, but it was so cool that we filled that hall with people that were comic book fans to see about your new comic book release of Evel Knievel.
Yeah, I'm, you know, I got to say, I'm a little surprised that there was never an Evel Knievel comic in the 1970s. That would have been a pretty natural thing for the companies to do, because I remember there was a movie. I remember there was a feature film at the time. So it's kind of amazing. I'm always kind of amazed when people miss the shot and when they miss the shot for like 40 years, you know.
Well, there was something. There was something, and we should talk about it. So, there was this baby. So, at the height of the toy's popularity, this wonderful Evel Knievel record-setting toy we were talking about, Ideal Toys, the company behind the toy, commissioned Marvel Comics to do this one shot. I don't know. It's like a 8 to 12 page Evel Knievel story. That is a beautiful cover by John Romita. I believe that is beautiful and iconic and wonderful. However, it's not much. This is basically it's like a 10-page instruction manual on how to acquire and play with the Evel Knievel toys. Yeah, and so it was a freebie. I mean, if you're watching the video, I know this isn't great video, but watch it. It says free. It was given away at Ideal Toy events, basically at toy stores. And it's kind of ridiculous where it's like, you know, the, you know, there's a kid that's in trouble, he needs help. And Evel Knievel's like, you know, let's talk about this over some refreshments in my scramble van. And then like the voice of God comes in and says, Evel Knievel's scramble van can be purchased in fine toy stores everywhere. it's just sort of that sort of thing. So what we are doing is actually the first Evel Knievel series. You know, this is the first substantial ongoing series. It is the first comic book effort that actually deals with, you know, the ins and outs of the man. And so it is important and it is historic. This original one shot is interesting as a piece of history, though, because when I grew up in the 80s, all of our children's content was sort of in this vein, right? He-Man, Transformers, G.I. Joe. We had this children's entertainment, these cartoons mm-hmm. that were actually just instruction manuals for how to acquire and play with the toys. They taught you how to play with the toys. That was the whole deal. And the roots of all of that really go back to this weird comic book that very few people even know about.
So that's like 74, 75, the comic?
That was 1974.
Yeah.
Yeah. And is it Romita doing the interior art as well?
No, it is not. He did the cover, and there aren't standard.
I'm really curious who knocked out those 8 pages for Stan.
Yeah. I mean,
lot of people say it was Vince Coletta who he's sparse on details, so he could do these things very quickly. Comic book, the backgrounds are pretty sparse.
Yeah.
That
happens. If you look at the adaptation of Raiders of the Lost Ark that Marvel did, it mm-hmm. is not, the art's really like, we had a week to get this thing in and get it on the stands before the movie came out. It's very rushed. It's very not great. And it's a pretty good artist. I think it actually is Romita again. Who obviously got a lot of these things. No, and look, people, you know, they did a great and successful comic book series with the Micronauts, which didn't even have any, it was just toys. There was no other universe of stuff that was from. Whereas mm-hmm. Evel Knievel is a real guy walking around the world doing amazing things. And it is funny that it didn't occur to them to do an ongoing, like in the 70s, you know.
I was looking at that art for the Micronauts. Was that guy's name Golden? Do you remember?
Yeah, Michael Golden. Yeah.
God, that was such good artwork for
It's the best. It's one of the most well-drawn comic book series ever. I've actually been meaning to get the trade paperback of it because it's finally back in print. but it's a great comic. Not to go off on a tangent, but I will say that my favorite thing about the Micronauts comic is it's the reason as a teenager I discovered Jack Kirby, because I had a friend who got really mm-hmm. frustrated with me for talking about how great the Micronauts was. And he was like, let me show you the original thing that this is ripping off, man. And that's how I discovered the New Gods and Mr. Miracle and the Forever People and the whole Jack Kirby Fourth World thing. And Dark Side, and I had to concede that yes, Dark Side is the original, and Baron Karza and Darth Vader are the Xeroxes of Dark Side. And you're absolutely right. The great thing is, it didn't at all affect my love of the Micronauts. I was perfectly willing to accept that it was a ripoff of a bunch of other cool shit, but it was its own cool shit too. And that's, you know. Shakespeare's just ripping up a bunch of folk tales. You know, it's a very common thing to do. We're all doing our own version of the stories. But that actually leads me segue to how much of the new comic are you basing on things that really happened to Evel in his life? How much of it is rooted in actual stunts he did and thing, you know, challenges he faced and all of that?
Yeah. I mean, that was the, When Kelly Knievel and I first started talking about doing this, right, the original pitch was, well, let's make Evel an adventurer. You have this guy who has this adventurous spirit, and he is like, he's a real life comic book, you know, superhero in general. This is a guy who literally leapt tall buildings in a single bound, and but was just like a rootin' tootin' ass kicking son of a bitch. Like you love to see, you know, he was John McClane in real life, you know. And so you have a really interesting base, and so you are starting with the actual guy, you know. I mean, the guy is as much an action hero as a living, breathing human being can be. So you're starting from there. But the original pitch was like, okay, well, let's make him an adventurer. Like, what is Evil's Smokey and the Bandit? What is his No Country for Old Men? That right. sort of thing. Right? Like, you know, inject him into some intrigue. And it is not without precedent, right? I mean, there was a Sam Elliott pilot, Evel Knievel television pilot in the 70s.
Oh, really?
Where they did something similar where it's like, well, Sam Elliott is playing Evel Knievel. He's traveling from town to town with his stunt show. He rolls into town. Some evil has set upon the town. Sure. He has to knock out the bad guys, court the beautiful woman in the town, make his jump, pack up and head to the next town. It was almost like, almost like a Santo movie, right? You know, Santo.
Well, it's, you know, the format comes from one of the most popular shows of all time, which is The Fugitive, which was then adapted to The Incredible Hulk, that was then adapted to Kung Fu, the thing of the guy going from town to town for various reasons, and then getting involved in whatever the local drama is, solving it and going on. I mean, hell, there's an element to that to friggin' Star Trek. They come to the town, you know, there's something going on in the town that's not good. Captain Kirk straightens everybody out, and then we go on our merry way to the next town. I mean, it's a great TV format idea. And before the Fugitive, I would say that you have like Route 66 does that. The two guys just bumming around America, getting involved in people's shit and moving on. I'm not quite sure if that's before or during The Fugitive that's used. But anyway, it's a great TV format. People have done it and done it and done it. And, you know,
wander the earth playing Kung Fu.
Exactly.
There was another really good precedent for it. There was a film in the 70s called Viva Knievel, which has its warts, but I love it. It is, you know, it is one of these kind
and Evil plays himself in that, right?
Yeah, he's playing himself wondrously. Yeah. And I love every second of it. And the whole thing kind of feels like a Rockford Files episode in like a really good, interesting way. even the music, you know, the orchestral music that's just kind of swinging as we go through in the action scenes. I'm a huge Rockford Files fan, and I'm like, this just feels like, you know, this feels like a season 4 episode of the Rockford Files starring Evel Knievel. It's amazing.
The orchestral music with a harmonica.
It's really good. So in that one, Evel Knievel again traveling with the stunt show, he gets duped by a businessman who is actually a drug smuggler, played by Leslie Nielsen, which is amazing.
Nice.
And so he dupes Evel into traveling down to Mexico to do this series of jumps. The idea is he's going to use Evil's caravan to smuggle a bunch of drugs into the United States. And Evel has to again knock out the bad guys, you know, bed Lauren Hutton and then pack up his stunt show and move on. So interesting precedent for this stuff. And so we started out trying to figure out, okay, well, what is his Smokey and the Bandit or whatever? And that was really interesting. But the more we talked to people, and the more I talked to Kelly, and the more I talked to guys like Joe, the more I realized a couple of things. One, the reality of Evel Knievel, the actual stories are so much more interesting than anything that anyone could ever conceive of. This guy lived kind of an action hero's life. And then really talking to the fans, you talk to them, even when I was interviewing artists, you know, I'm talking to Ray Anthony Height about maybe doing a cover, and he's like, oh, you got to include this and you got to do this. And I heard about this one time where he did this. More than anyone, Evel Knievel has... he just elicits this response from everybody. And the more I realized is the more it's like, well, so if you go to see Journey in concert, you go to see Bon Jovi in concert, like you want to hear the hits, right? You don't want to hear the stuff from the new album. You want to hear the hits. And so we just realized very quickly over time, well, it's like, well, people are going to want to, they want to see Caesar's Palace. They want to see Snake River Canyon. And if they don't get that, they're going to be disappointed. And so the older fans who know Evel backwards and forwards, they want to see that stuff. There are a lot of new comic book fans who know of Evel Knievel, but they don't know the history. And so to a certain degree, those people need to be educated. They need to be taught why this guy is just the baddest mofo low down in any town, in any time. And so that became the mission, is like, well, let's present the history lovingly, respectfully. Let's, you know, this is a folk hero. Let's present the folk tales. Let's embrace that and celebrate that. But let's also make him an adventurer. And so what you see is kind of a, you know, a no country old man for old men, you know, sort of tale where he is wrapped up in drama with an outlaw motorcycle club, which is actually rooted in history also, because he very historically clashed verbally and physically with the Hell's Angels over the course of his actual life. And so we have worked in something like that, but it is all set against the backdrop of the actual history. Issue one starts out with him jumping Caesar's Palace, becoming essentially overnight the, you know, the most famous man in America. And then issue four, the last issue of the first arc, ends with him jumping Snake River Canyon. And we hit all of these like really interesting highlights over the course, him brawling with the Hell's Angels at the Cow Palace, the infamous $1 million party in Butte, Montana. And we have fun with it. You know, sometimes we're presenting the facts and sometimes we're presenting the legend, and how all of that gets legislated, I think, is the really interesting thing.
Sure. Sure. I figured that. I mean, I figured you were putting a fictional framework on some of the real stuff. I want to say for the record that the movie Viva Knievel was written by a couple of guys, but the writer that probably made it feel like a Rockford Files episode, a guy named Norman Katkov, who wrote Mission Impossible episodes and Dynasty and Days of Our Lives and Kung Fu. He wrote two episodes of Kung Fu. Like, you know, amazing. He was that guy writing that kind of material. And the director, Igor Douglas, not for nothing, director of In Like Flint and one of the greatest low budget monster movies of all time, Them! Exclamation point. So, you know, he knew what he was doing. That was it. It is the last movie he made. it was the very end of his career. But yeah, there's a long history of fictionalized exploits of legendary people. You know, I got news for you. All that shit didn't happen to Daniel Boone either. So, you know, I think, you know, or Davy Crockett for that matter, while we're talking about Fess Parker. But yeah, it's a, you know, and evil is ripe for that kind of American folklore treatment. Do you have a plan when this is, it's been successful so far, to do another series?
Yeah, I mean, I am having the time of my life doing this, and getting to, you know, meet the fans and learn all the history. And again, I think this is such a, I mean, Joe and I are in a similar boat where, well, you know, evil is this thing. He's this institution. And I think that there are people that become part of the story. Joe became part of the story when he, you know, signed on to be a partner at the Evel Knievel Museum. And I became, you know, a later part of the story when I became the guy who was writing them in comic books. And I take that responsibility very seriously. You know, this is, I've wanted to write this for a very long time. And so as long as Kelly Knievel and the Evel Knievel brand will allow me to do Evel Knievel stories, I will do them. People seem to want them. People seem to be kind of enjoying what we're setting forward. But, you know, I mean, from a writing standpoint, again, our listeners have, they have watched my journey over the course of these 5 years that we've been on. And as a writer, you know, I mean, my day job is writing film and TV, and I started writing comic books on the side because it gave me this freedom to do whatever I wanted to do. But when you write a couple of pretty good comic books, then people start showing up and they offer you gigs, right? And people would show up and be like, hey, do you want to, you know, I'm not going to name any names, but they would show up and be like, hey, do you want to do a short arc on this property? And the answer would almost, it would always be no. And it was for a couple of reasons, like, you know, no shade thrown on anything, but one, like, I didn't have the bandwidth often. Often I was busy writing, I was too busy writing film and TV to do anything other than my comic books. But then also, often it would just be, well, I'm not the guy for that book, you know, I'm not going to take an arc on something just to work and all of that stuff. I need to be able to I need to be able to figure out what I love about it. And that's a skill. But I couldn't always do it, but there, you know, there's a guy to write that arc. It wasn't me, but at mm-hmm. some point it was a very smart editor who had come to me. And I think it was the third time he had come to me and said, "Hey, do you want to do this one shot on this?" And I was like, no, I don't think so. Thanks so much. Keep thinking of me. Keep coming back to me. And then at some point he was like, "Well, dude, what do you want to write? You know, sooner or later, you're going to have to figure it out." And I took that to heart. He was absolutely right. And so I had to sit down and I had to figure out, well, what do I want to write? And so I sat down and I made a list of, you know, probably 5 to 10 properties, characters that I would love to write in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And most all of them had not been represented in comics before. And that was really interesting. And it just so happens, well, I am embedded in the entertainment industry and, you know, and know a little bit about making deals and, you know, selling IP and lining up IP. And so, Evel Knievel was right at the top of the list. And I couldn't believe that he hadn't been given the proper comic book treatment. And so, twist and a turn later, I'm on the phone with Kelly Knievel for about a month, and we worked out how to do this. But yeah, so it's like, this was the dream come true. Evel Knievel was number one on the list. And after someone had challenged me and said, "Figure out what you want to write," mm-hmm. like Babe Ruth, I pointed to the fence and I said, "This is it." And now I got it. And I think we're doing a pretty good job with it. And I think we're having a good time doing it. And so hopefully Kelly will let me keep going with it.
What do you, as a writer for screens and for pages, which would be better fit for Evel Knievel's story, movies or television, after your comic book?
After the comic book. You could do either. It's weird because I think like if you had asked me that question, like even 2 years ago, I might've had a different answer. I don't know what is good for anything anymore with the way this film business is going. It's interesting because it's like, you can do a really interesting poppy ass kicking movie with Evel Knievel, right? You know, if you wanted to do the Evel Knievel's Smokey and the Bandit movie, where it's like almost he's playing a character, that would be wonderful. That would be amazing. But if you're going to do the Evel Knievel story, the biopic, right, you're actually going to get the intricacies of the man. Maybe you need a little more runway. I mean, this is a guy who changed over time in such an interesting, dynamic way that being able to give it the 6-episode, HBO series treatment would be kind of awesome, I think, and really delve into it and really delve into how he... Because it is this guy who, you know, we talked about this a little bit in the panel, but it's like, well, he starts out as you know, Robert Craig Knievel. He starts out as Bobby, you know, and then starts to kind of starts to play this character Evel, and then the movie comes out, and they kind of turn the volume up, you know, on that, you know, to 10, and then he's less evil and more evil in the movie for a while. And he becomes more and more evil and less Robert. Right. Yeah. At some point, almost to his detriment. And then I think he spends the later half of his life becoming Robert again in a really interesting way.
One of his quotes was, "I invented Evel Knievel and it kind of got away from me."
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think if you're going to tell the story over time, that is the thrust of it. That is the thematics, right? It's a treatise on fame, right? It's like, well, you step onto a stage and you play a character and everybody expects you to show up as that person every time. And if the last time you were on the stage, you were turned up to 10, well, you better be turned up to 10 the next time. There's not a lot of room for nuance. There wasn't in the 70s and there certainly isn't now. Mm-hmm. We're seeing it all over. I mean, we see it with our entertainment. We see it with our politics. We see it with, just everything in between. Right. Like, well, you better be turned up to 10. And we don't take days off. We don't, make room for nuance. We don't deal in gray areas. I think that's so interesting.
Yeah. I mean, my two cents is I would definitely lean towards television for it. Because I think that, and especially jumping off from a comic book, because in a comic book, you're already dealing with an episodic short form subject. So if you want to, like, if you're, particularly if you're adapting the comic, I think you want to go to television. That doesn't necessarily have to be how you go, but also just looking at the market, I would think that the character, you know, that format from the Sam Elliott show is not a bad one, and it's good. It's a good, and also I think in a world where you have shows like Poker Face, you could absolutely do it as a period thing. That's a little bit of a pastiche of what those shows were like in the 1970s, in that way that Poker Face is essentially Columbo, with just a wearing a slightly different costume. Like, they even use the same font in the credits, which is pretty dedicated to me. But yeah, and I, you know, I think, I honestly think audiences, we love the super serialized stuff, but man, the adventure of the week thing is so great, and we all kind of miss it. You know, thing where you could turn into an episode of something like Star Trek, and if you missed the last week's episode, you weren't lost. It was a whole new planet, a whole new set of problems. You know what the ongoing threads are. You know what everyone's deal is, but you don't need to go like, oh, what happened last week?
Right.
And again, I love serialized stuff. My favorite show ever is one of the shows that more or less invented hyper-serialization in genre shows, which was called Crime Story in 1987 and 1988.
Yeah. Michael
Mann. Which was essentially a TV season that was a 22-hour, you know, The Godfather Part 2 for television, but it's 22 hours long. And that was how it was conceived, and no one had really done that before. And now every TV show is that. Every TV show is a 12-hour movie or a 13-hour movie or... You know, and look, everyone praises Andor, and it's an incredible show. But if there's one thing watching that show tells you, it's that Tony Gilroy does not want to watch television, doesn't want to write television. He wants to write 3 2.5-hour long movies that comprise a 9-episode, you know, TV series, or, you know, 4 2.5-hour long movies that that are broken into 3 parts and shown. What I love is he kind of invented a new version of television. That idea that it's 4 3-episode miniseries actually that all, you know, lock together is a completely new thing. But the whole 22 random things that happened to our hero this year, I like that format, and I love to see it.
Yeah.
I mean, if I'm going to do the TV series, there's a, you know, again, like, you look back at Game of Thrones and it's like, do you remember the dragon episode? Do you remember the episode where they had this battle? It's like, if you're doing the actual Evel Knievel story, it is so ripe for that. It's like, oh shit, did you see the Caesars episode? Did you see the Million Dollar Party episode? I can't wait for them to do Wembley. Oh, are they going to do Wembley? They're not doing Wembley this season. We got to wait for next season. And that is the thing. And it gets people excited about it. It gets people going out and trying to figure out, well, what's going to be next? Well, they're going to have to do this next season. They're going to do that next season. You know, oh wow, they're flashing back to do the jump over the cougars at the motorcycle shop.
You've just listed a lot of, and the other thing is, this is an essential tension between television and movies, and it's an essential tension in television, is when we tell a story, any story, the idea is this is the most important thing that happened to the main character ever. This is their most important story. You can't really, that's movies. So in a movie, your 2-hour long Evel Knievel thing, you have to go like, this is the biggest Evel Knievel adventure ever. And worse, then you got to do a sequel where it's also the biggest. And that kind of torpedoes move, you know, whereas when you have a guy who a lot of fascinating things happen to, that's better for television, because it isn't like to you, it was the most incredible stunt you've ever seen in your life. To me, it was Tuesday. You know, like that's, you know, Evil has this endless series of real adventures that you can, you know, feather into the story. And that really, that lends itself to serialized thing. When you have someone to whom a remarkable thing happens once a week anyway. So yeah, that's, you know, that's my two cents. And I think those kind of characters lend themselves to serialized stories. And a lot of times in series television, the character who's having the most important thing in the world that ever happened to them is the guest star.
Oh yeah.
The person, you know, Evil encounters them. They have the greatest week of their life. And then he moves on to someone else's next greatest week of their life. And that's another TV format. I went back and watched some Old Man from Uncle's, and I was kind of surprised that the format of that show is that every week Napoleon Solo finds a civilian who's involved with a criminal spy thing, takes over their lives, puppeteers them until they do what he wants and bring down the bad guy, and then he goes on his merry way, having completely disrupted their life. But supposedly gotten them out of whatever hideous situation they were in with foreign spies or blackmail or whatever. But I had forgotten that the format wasn't Napoleon Solo goes in and solves the problem himself like James Bond. It's Napoleon Solo shows up, surveys the situation and goes, I can use this guest star to get what I want. And those shows are
just so happens fun. This guy's played by Robert Urich, so
right, exactly. Or you know, there's one episode that actually has both Shatner and Nimoy on it prior to Star Trek. And Shatner is the innocent bystander whose life gets upended, and Nimoy is the foreign secret agent.
They were both in Columbo episodes. Shatner was an actor that had killed his manager, and Nimoy was a doctor who was trying to extend his research window. And
I feel like Shatner comes back twice. I feel like there's a second one as well.
They would do that a lot too. I mean, going back through those where it's like, well, yeah, you know, this woman played it. You know, she guest starred as one character in season three. Yeah. Now it's season six. People aren't able to go on and stream these and nobody's going to remember it. So she is now.
Exactly. Like you had two shots to see an episode of a TV show. And until it went into syndication, those were the only two. I love when you look at the IMDb and you find some old character actor, you'll literally see, you know, Bob Smith, Gunsmoke, five episodes. Five character names.
Different. Gerald McRaney in the Rockford Files. Like Stephen Cannell loved Gerald McRaney. Gerald McRaney played like 10 different roles, and sometimes he's like a bellhop, sometimes he's a cop, sometimes he's a. Yeah. But it's like, oh my god, it's Rick Simon. Oh my god, it's.
Yeah. No, look, Jerry Orbach played a defense attorney on the first season of Law and Order, and then. Who cares? He's also Lenny Briscoe, our lead man for 5 years. You know, it's whatever works. But I was wondering, are you planning on selling the comic book in the new museum when it opens?
What do you think, Joe?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're going to do that.
Yeah.
And tell us about... Go ahead, Ryland.
Oh, no, I was just going to say it would be wonderful to do like a deluxe museum edition and go and present it there and have an event and all that stuff. That's really what I'm looking forward to. I mean, I know you guys are building and all that stuff, but go there and celebrate it in the proper place, you know?
Tell
us about the new museum and what's the timetable on that?
Okay, the new museum is about 30,000 square feet of awesomeness. We'll have even more motorcycles. As I mentioned before, we've got about a dozen in Kansas, but Kelly, we're merging the collection with Kelly Knievel is adding some artifacts to it. Sky Cycle, Rocket Trike, the Shark Bike from Chicago.
Amazing.
And so we'll nearly double our inventory of kick-ass stuff. So it's on two levels. It's in it's in downtown Las Vegas. If you know anything about that.
Yeah. You before we went live, you said Fremont Street. It'll be
it's on close Fremont to Street. Fremont Street. Yes, yeah. Downtown. Yeah,
near the Fremont
it's a little Street bit south experience. Of Fremont.
Okay, that's cool, but still accessible from people who are visiting that part of town.
Yeah, that's right. It's a cool part of town.
Absolutely.
Locals are all excited about it because they actually go there where they won't go to the Strip.
Yeah.
It's more affordable to the Strip. It's accessible to anybody that stays on the Strip, but ultra accessible to anybody staying downtown.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you miss Vegas being what it was 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago, Fremont Street is where you go to have that experience because it's not to be found on the Strip at all. The Strip, the first time I saw Vegas was passing through it in 1987, moving to Los Angeles, and that place doesn't exist anymore. Like, I remember, yeah. Like, where the Mondrian is now. Mondrian? Was where it just became sand. It was like, amazing. The road ended, and there was Caesar's Palace, and then there was the desert, you know, right next to Caesar's Palace, and it's gone. Yeah. And first hotel I ever stayed in Vegas was the Aladdin, which I watched be destroyed on television some years later. After 1990. I was there in 1990 for the Aladdin, making an Andy Sidaris movie. And I can't remember when they destroyed it, but it was not too terribly long after that. Mm-hmm. But that's great. And what's the timetable? When do you think you'll be open in Vegas?
In a few weeks. I'm not sure when this episode that's noon. Comes out, but we'll be open in spring of 2026.
Oh, okay. That's great.
Yeah, it's fun. And it's the natural home for the Evel Knievel Museum. One is that place has become a museum hub since you've been there last.
Sure.
They've added Zach Bagans Haunted Museum. They've got the Neon Museum, which has really adopted the history of Las Vegas. It's got
the Liberace Museum.
The Liberace Museum. Nice. Yes. Love that one. Oh man, I love that one. It's housed it's a great in museum. Michael. You've been there?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's housed in Michael Jackson's hideout called Thrilla Villa. When Michael Jackson disappeared from your part of the world, Los Angeles, he hid out in Las Vegas underground. There are very few buildings with basements in Las Vegas, but this is one of them.
Yeah.
And it turns out to be a perfect place for a museum because it's climate controlled and there's no light. And it's not climate controlled. It is, but naturally. And,
right.
It's just a great place for a museum. They've got the punk rock museum there. And then punk rock's brother, Evel Knievel, will be there now.
Interesting. and we were talking about the Burlesque Hall of Fame being right in that area.
Which, okay.
Yes, unfortunately, the Burlesque Museum is closing this year, I think. They had overextended themselves a little bit. But they do have the Miss Exotic World contest every year, which is was connected to the Burlesque Hall of Fame. And there were some exhibits in there, photos of my wife and things like that. I was there for the grand opening.
Photos of my wife. David. Yeah. So just so you know, geographically, David, that is across the street from the Evel Knievel Museum.
Oh, okay.
Love it.
Okay, cool.
They have photos of your wife in there. That's pretty awesome.
They did. Yeah, they did. They had, I can't remember what she,
is she a burlesque
once upon
person?
A time. She was. Yeah. She started around 99 2000. She was making a documentary about the Velvet Hammer Burlesque, which was a great burlesque show in Los Angeles, and she kind of fell in love with it as an art form and as a thing that people were doing. So as she was making her documentary, she started performing, and she had the kind, you know, the when you're early in your career at something and you get really seriously encouraged. The first time she ever performed like burlesque in front of people, I think, or one of the first times, she won runner up at the Miss Exotic World contest. And she's like, oh, okay, I think I'll do this now. She did a Bride of Frankenstein act, which ended with a large stage hand dressed as Frankenstein dragging her off stage. we've had trouble my wife is petite, but we always had trouble like finding a big enough dude to like literally be able to pick her up and throw her on his shoulder and walk off stage. But yeah, the last time I was on Fremont Street was for the, and it was that hotel that's sort of where Fremont Street dead ends. I can't remember the name of the hotel.
Plaza.
Yeah, it was the Plaza. That's right. Mm-hmm. Which is really great. And which really that hotel feels like old Vegas. Like a lot of the decor has not been updated.
Yeah.
You know, you're,
well, and it is. It's the set for the opening of Casino with Sharon Stone as she's tipping the valets and walking in.
Yep. And it's in the opening credits of Crime Story when they moved to Vegas, which is based on the same true story as Casino. One of my favorite pieces of trivia, because it's the most absurd thing in the world, is the character that is played by Robert De Niro in Casino.
Yeah.
Is played by Andrew Dice Clay. Incredible. In Crime Story.
Yeah.
The same dude. And the Joe Pesci character is played by Anthony Dennison, which makes me really wonder, like, what did that guy look like? Because he was either really handsome or kind of a little troll. Like, you know, like, what's the middle ground? He actually wasn't that good. It was a guy named Tony the Ant Spilotro.
Right.
Is who he's based on.
And another funny thing is, that Rosenthal character, neither one of those guys looks... The Rosenthal character is not Italian, but he's being played by Andrew Dice Clay and Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah. Well, Clay is Woody Jewish. Allen. So Clay got it. Clay is actually closer casting to it. It is a funny... To me, it kind of shows, though, like, I love Scorsese, but in his later career, he sure has made a lot of movies that, like... are, I let a guy lie to me about how important he was, and I made a whole movie about it. You know, like, Rosenthal's not that big a deal. Rosenthal is not the star of the mafia story in Las Vegas by any stretch of the imagination, but he thinks he is, and he wrote a book about it, or he, you know, at least told Scorsese a story about it, and Scorsese was like, I love it.
It's a great movie.
It is a great movie. Yeah. It's just, you know, it's a funny, it's a guy like sort of aggrandizing how big a deal he was, which is, you know, also true of the Irishman. Every FBI agent in the world told Scorsese, this guy did not kill Hoffa, man. Like, don't listen to him. And he's like, I'm making the movie anyway. Okay. Like, whatever. Can't talk you out of it. But yeah, it's funny stuff. Are you guys having a grand opening thing for the museum? What's the plan? Is there planning for that yet?
Oh, sure. Yeah. We'll have a grand opening that lasts probably a year. Oh, so okay. We can't have every event in one weekend. So we'll spread it out a while.
Interesting. Sure. So do you have a couple of events like in mind? What are the events on those?
I'm not going to tell you yet.
You're not going
to? I'm not ready to say yet.
I'm not telling you.
No. Yeah. They're huge and they're great and it's going to be a lot of fun.
Nice. Yeah.
I was thinking one that you mentioned, Ryland, is the toys. They're pretty grown man serious about how far their toys can jump.
Yeah.
Oh, funny.
Modify these, and some have, instead of the crank, they've rigged it so they put a drill motor in it.
Oh, man, that is hilarious.
So one of the things we've really wanted to do out here to promote the comic book Kickstarter, but the problem is, like, we were building a business and we were launching this big campaign, and so it would have been like basically another planning another giant event would have been, it was prohibitive. But what we wanted to do was do an evil toy Pinewood Derby out here in Los Angeles. We were talking to people. There's a there's a really nice vintage toy shop in Burbank, and they were going to give us the parking lot. We were going to have a food truck there, and we were going to invite people down to jump their toys and give trophies out and all that stuff. It would have been, if evil is the first job, this would have been a second job. And so we were going to do something like that.
So fun.
Nice. Yeah. But
I'm pretty sure my Evel Knievel action figure mostly fought with the apes from Planet of the Apes. Like when I played with him, I mean, he and Steve Austin were fist fighting gorillas from Planet of the Apes. Because obviously the Evel Knievel thing didn't come with bad guys. Like there was no, you know, your Star Trek action figure, you had that one Klingon guy that you could get. But I'm pretty sure what I had him, phase off against the Planet of the Apes, because that's what I had that was in the same scale. Because he wasn't the G.I. Joe size and he wasn't the Star Wars size. He was in that middle ground that was also the Steve Austin size.
Evil went toe-to-toe with Death every day. That was his enemy.
Right. Who was that? There was no action figure for Death.
No. No. So I subbed, in the gorillas.
Yeah, so you were talking about it. I mean, are you going to do a toy jumping event at the museum? Are we breaking news with that, or are we getting some inside info?
Yeah, that's going to happen. The fans are not going to let that not happen.
Yeah.
So you can bring the food truck and bring your weapon of choice. Most of them are stunt cycles, but there were other ideal toys, as you know from this comic book.
Yeah,
there was a sky cycle, a scramble van. What else? The wheelie car, the crash car. Yeah.
And you have some of the stuff actually at the museum, though. Like you have the real life equivalents, correct?
Yes, that's correct. So as you were saying, that comic book was an advertisement for the toys that were made in 1974. The molds for those toys have been found and they're being remade. The gyros are reworked a little bit just to improve them. So they're reissued now, and they're still making those toys. They're made by California Creations. We'll have those toys available at the museum. They're available now online at our Shopify store.
That's amazing. So the toys are available.
Yep. They're super popular.
The toys are available, but you have the actual crash car at the museum. Am I wrong about that?
Oh, the real thing. Yeah, the real version. Yeah, I've got the real version of, well, the stunt cycle, of course. And the crash car is great. In the comic book, it was made to blow into a million pieces, almost as a decoy.
I remember that.
To blunt the force of the collision. And in real life, it was able to pop its door. It would ride into like a hay bale, and the hood would blow off, and the doors were supposed to blow open, and then steam would pour out of these gas cylinders that were hidden. So it looked like it was on fire. So great. So awesome. So we've got that in the museum. Crash car. Yes.
And let's take a moment to talk about Dave Acosta, who did the art. Dave did your interior art, right? Yeah.
Dave Acosta of Elvira fame, of David Avalone partnership fame. He's knocking it out of the park doing the interior art on the, as well as our good friend Ray Anthony Height did a wonderful cover for us. We have a cover from John Pinto. We have a cover from Flops. We have a cover from Fabio Alves, who is a longtime artist for me. He did The Jump. He was nominated for a Ringo Award for the covers he did for us on Banjax. It is a really amazing group of people. Davi Leon Diaz, who does a lot of my other books, The Peacekeepers, did Aberrant. He's doing a lot of interior matter. With Acosta being, very busy on Thundercats and Elvira and all the other wonderful things he's drawing. So it's quite the team. It's like the Super Friends. Yeah.
Nice. So and how many pages is the comic?
The first story will be, the primary story is 30 pages. And then we are adding interior matter as the campaign unfolds. There are a couple of things. So one of the amazing things that you can get if you go to the Evel Knievel Kickstarter campaign is that you can buy, there's a tier you can back where you get an original Evel Knievel story written about you. It is a 5-page story starring you interacting with Evel Knievel. You are a member of Evel's Motorcycle Daredevils, which was his original stunt troupe before he started jumping on his own. And we have already had a gentleman take us up on that offer. There are others.
Awesome.
There are others to be had. We've had, I think, 5 people who have asked to be actually just drawn into the comic book in general. Exactly. And you know, because it's Evel Knievel, people are really excited about it. And so we are doing original Evel, you know, we are adding stories as things go. One of the other sort of campaign twists and turns is, again, each issue, this first issue deals specifically with Caesar's Palace. And so so one of the stretch goals, are interesting. We decided that we are building over time an Evel Knievel ephemera pack. And so the first two stretch goals, the first stretch goal when we funded, you get an original Evel Knievel Caesar's Jump ticket. Rachel, our designer, has done some amazing work. She has gone into the history and found event posters, has found ephemera that was kind of lost to history. Sometimes there's only like a crude, you know, sort of, sometimes it's like a photo of something in a background. And so she has recreated these posters, just standard, standard items you can get with the campaign. She recreated a lost to history Caesar's Palace poster. She recreated a lost to history Motorcycle Daredevils poster, and nice. They're beautiful. Yeah. And they're 10x12 and they're on archival paper and they look gorgeous in a frame, like my Snake River poster back here. So you have those, but she is starting to build out. And so all the stretch goals are the Caesar's Palace ephemera pack. So you start out, you get a ticket for the jump, and she's recreated that, and it's gorgeous. It looks like an Evel Knievel jump ticket. The second one is a postcard you could get at the Caesar's Palace gift shop in 1967, with a little Evel Knievel bent to it. And so we're building all these things out. Oh, well, here's what an ad in the newspaper would have looked like for the jump in 1967. We're adding that, but there's all that stuff. But as you get further down the line, back to the how long is the issue question, well, the history is so interesting. And, you know, I'm a huge fan of Greg Rucka's Lazarus. It's a great book. And Rucka does all of this amazing research for the issue. And a lot of it goes into, you know, it goes into AI, it goes into medical science, it goes into cloning, it goes into all these things. He does all this reading. And then based on that research, he writes an issue. And then he has this back matter in the issue that is basically like a, you know, I don't know what you want to call it, a treatise, a book report, a presentation of all of the research he did to fuel the issue. And in my experience, a lot of times that back matter, that history, that research that he did is even more interesting than the comic book, which is one of the best comic books written. So long-winded way of saying, at some point, we trigger a pretty cool stretch goal where we will add historical research back matter to the book, hopefully. With the help of Joe and our friends at the Evel Knievel Museum, who obviously know the history backwards and forwards and know it better than anyone else, and we'll make sure that we keep it loose and keep it tight and tidy. So
keep it loose and tight and tidy. Yeah. Yeah, you've done a great job so far. I was thinking about the how that history folds into fiction and how it never really was clear.
Yeah,
because everybody involved's got their own perspective, and especially the star of the show's got a kind of, he's what an ego.
Yeah, sure.
But it's been fun to work with you, Rylan. And the things that we talked about with Caesar's being built as, you know, how it looked like it was really built after the Vatican, not what was the Colosseum?
The
Colosseum makes such a better story.
Yeah,
it does. Being the last gladiator.
Well, I mean, it's so funny. I mean, it was something that it was such a pleasure to spend time with you and the Knievels at San Diego Comic Con, and I think Joe is more aware of this than anybody, where he could kind of see me working, and so I have, in doing this, like any good writer would, I have consumed every bit of Evel Knievel content I could. I watched all the documentaries. I read all the books. You know, I talked to as many people as possible. And so there are these stories, there are these legendary stories. Let's say it's like the, the top 10, the top 20 Evel Knievel stories, right? And you know, I heard him in this documentary, I read about him in this book, but then I would, at opportune times, I would grab Joe and I would get Joe's take on that story. And then I would grab Kelly and I would get Kelly's take on that story. And it was interesting to see, well, where do these line up? Where do they yeah. differ? You know, how many different versions of the story are there? And here's the thing is that often when the man told the story, Evel would tell a story one way. You can just find the footage. He would tell a story one way. And then 2 years later, he'd be telling the same story, but you know, the guy got bigger and he was in a coma longer and all of these things. And it is the truth of the man, the truth of the story is this. And it's so interesting. And you know, in dealing with the Caesar's Palace crash, well, you know, the official story for the longest time was that Evel crashed. He was in a coma in the hospital for 29 days. But the reality of it was probably that Jay Sarno paid off a bunch of people to perpetuate this story that Evel was fighting for his life and that Evel was mostly fine the next day. But it added to the legend. But that
sure.
that juxtaposition is so interesting to me. And we will deal with that in the comic book where it's like I do believe our Caesar's Palace comic book ends with him stating, you know, I was in the hospital for 29 days. However, when we start issue 2, he's going to examine that further and be like, well, yep. you know, this is what they were saying and this is why they were saying it. And this, here was the reality of it. But again, this idea where it's like, well, what is the truth and how do we define truth and what is the more interesting truth and what do we want to hang on to? That is the larger truth of the book. And I'm in love with it.
Yep. Yeah. Look, I mean, I've been a lifelong student of history, and one of the first things you learn is if you read one book on a topic, mm-hmm. you don't really know the topic. You know what that guy wanted to tell you about the topic. You read mm-hmm. 8 books on the topic, you start to form a general opinion, and you go, enough people have said this one thing that is true. But you also get things like one historian says a thing that's not true, and then that historian is used as a source by everyone else moving forward. And then you get nothing but bullshit going forward because everyone's repeating the lie that this guy made up for one reason or another. So it's more fun when it's not serious political history and when it's legends of a great performer, you can have a lot more fun with it yeah. Than you can when it matters a lot what the truth is. It doesn't matter a lot. How long Evel Knievel was in the hospital. And that's what's great about it is anything can be true. And, you know, and the print, the legend, the man who shot Liberty Valance of it all. Sometimes the lie inspires people and is more important than the truth.
Yeah.
Like if the lie is the thing that makes everyone do what they're supposed to do, if the lie makes people do good works or whatever, then maybe it was a good lie to tell. So it's all a very complicated dealing with anyone's legacy like that. Yeah. You have to decide what your version of it is or present all of them and say, here's a bunch of ways it might have gone. And we don't really know.
I mean, I also think there's an opportunity here and there's a responsibility to like get the man right overall. I mean,
sure.
All the stuff we're talking about is interesting and it's funny and it's glorious and it's wonderful. And it's the reason people are going to show up. But once you have them, it was important for me to get things right. And I think it was what I did with Joe and certainly what I did with Kelly. And I'm like, well, what do people miss and what don't people know and what doesn't get said enough? And you know, Kelly is the steward of his father's legacy, right? And there are things that he is excited about in terms of the way that his dad has been, you know, I mean, his dad is right. about to become, the Smithsonian Museum is about to name him, you know, one of their official American heroes or whatever. I think there are like 10 of them and Kelly's dad, Evel Knievel, is one of them. And that's like this huge honor and this big deal. And that is, you know, that is a, you know, that's a, you know, that, I mean, that's what you want. However, you know, from a personal standpoint, there are things that people just don't get right necessarily. And it's like, well, it has been covered backwards and forwards that he was a daredevil, that he was a gunslinger, that he, you know, that he drank, that he liked women, that he, whatever. Right. But he was also a good dad. And he also took care of his family, and he also fought for things he believed in, and all of these things. And you know, all of these, you know, these are very heroic things. When you read a book, you will get a version of, well, evil was this kind of dad. But in talking to Kelly's like, I read that book. It had no basis in reality. This is how me and my siblings felt about it. We woke up every day and this is what happened. It is such an opportunity for me, for us, for this team to kind of like cement that into the story, and to present that when it doesn't get presented enough, because all this other stuff is more interesting and more shiny and whatever. And so it is one of the things we're trying to do with the book is to really, let's get the legend, let's show the folk hero, but let's get the man right also. What he stood for, what his values were, all of those things. And I think that's wonderful. If we can leave having done that and having had a bunch of fun doing that and entertain people while doing that, I think that this was a massive success.
Nice. Nice. Well, we should probably wrap up, but Joe, is there a website for the museum? Where can people find more information about you and about the Even Evil Museum?
Yeah, our website is www.evilknievelmuseum.com. And on that page, there will be updates when we have a grand opening date. And there's also a Shopify link there for swag.
Nice. Nice. And Rylan, where can people find you?
I am at Rylan Grant on all forms of social media. That is R-Y-L-E-N-D-G-R-A-N-T. If you are just listening, most of you are just listening. But I have to spell it because it's not a real name. My parents just kind of drunkenly arranged letters and saddled me with it. And so now I have to spell it for everybody. My company, of course, the company presenting this wonderful podcast, is Half Evil Comics, and the Evil Knievel comic book series, issue one of The Last Gladiator, the first arc, is available on Kickstarter right now. So go on over and check it out. It's a wonderful book made by wonderful people about a wonderfully boisterous, lovable lunatic who you're all going to, you know, you all already know and love, but you're going to read this and you're going to know him and love him better. So
can I just say about that Kickstarter campaign? Yeah. Your swag is so cool and so exclusive. And it's neat to see a new take on what's available. That's so great. That Scramble Van is so cool.
Yeah, we have the posters I was talking about. We have pins. I got to design Evil Knievel skateboards, which is a dream come true. Metal covers, foil covers, stuff you will only be able to get here and now. So if you are an Evil Knievel fan, check it out. Yeah, the posters are so good. I'm so proud of those posters. So please show up and get the posters.
Yeah.
All right. And you can find me. I'm going to be at LA Comic Con this weekend at table K10 in Kentia Hall. I have no idea where Kentia Hall is. So good.
Oh, wow.
Good weird. Luck finding me. Yeah, that's where Artist Alley is now. And I don't know how that's going to work out. And I used to give out the website address as the easiest place to find me, but I started a Patreon a couple of months ago, and that's become a much better central location for me. If you go to Patreon and search for my name, you will find me. There is a lot of information on the free side. You can join as a subscriber at very, very, very low prices if the mood strikes you. Best Mystery Stories of 2025 is out now. My next comic is still many months away, so we won't talk about that just yet. But thanks for listening, Joe. Thanks for joining us, and we will see you all on the next exciting episode of The Writer's Block.
Happy landings.
Happy landings.
If you're watching us on YouTube, be sure to smash that like button. If you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or other fine purveyors of ear crack, please leave us a 5-star review. And wherever you're watching and or listening, subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. We'll see you back here next week for more Madcap hijinks on The Writer's Block.
For more information, visit pendantaudio.com. Thanks for listening.